So what I'm going to talk about is the limits of duty as it applies to promissory obligations, duties that have their origins in a promise. So let me start out by saying some general things about obligation and justification, which are, as I say, are general things, but are important for the discussion of promising in particular. So I'm going to say that a promise binds when the promisor would wrong the promisee by breaching their promise. So I made a binding promise to be at the bus stop, or as I also say, a valid promise. So I don't have to repeat the same word over and over again, I'll alternate them. I've made a binding or valid promise to be at the bus stop, to you to be at the bus stop, when I'd be wronging you if I didn't appear in virtue of making that promise. So there are some promises that don't bind. So and there are various reasons why they don't bind. For instance, you might have put a gun to my head in order to get me to promise to be at the bus stop. And most people would agree that wouldn't be a binding promise. So I wouldn't be wronging you by failing to appear at the bus stop had you got the promise out of me by putting a gun to my head. But nevertheless, many promises do bind, and when they do bind, that's what this means, that you'd be wronging the promisee by breaching the promise. So what does wronging mean? Well, I think there are two connotations of wronging on which I'll focus. One is to do with our emotions, our reactive attitudes. Where there's a wronging, where someone's wronged, blame and guilt are usually appropriate. So guilt in the wrongdoer and blame in the wronged party and third parties. It's very complicated. I say usually, normally, there's lots of complications here. For instance, one important for our purposes is that the wrongdoer might have an excuse for doing. I forgot my partner's birthday because I've had a hard week at work, that sort of thing. That's an excuse. And the effect of an excuse is not, I think, to render guilt inappropriate. I think you should still feel somewhat guilty if you forget your partner's birthday, even though you've had a hard week at work. But what it would render inappropriate is blame by other people or by your partner. So that's the effect of an excuse, is to block, not to block guilt, but to block blame. But anyway, in the normal case where there isn't an excuse and justification and so on, blame and guilt are appropriate for a wronging. The second connotation of wronging is that where something would constitute a wronging, that is in itself a reason to avoid it, some reason to avoid it. So if I make a valid binding promise, then there's some reason to keep the promise, to avoid the wronging that is consequent on breaching it. So it makes sense to fulfill a binding promise. There's something to be said for it, because the promise is binding. Now, that's different from it being justified for you to keep the promise, or for it to be the case that you ought, as they say, all things considered, to keep the promise. So there are valid binding promises that you ought not to keep, because there are more weighty considerations on the other side, because there are more weighty obligations conflicting, whatever it might be. We'll go through lots of examples of this. So there can be, and this is something I'll go on about a bit in a moment, a justified wronging, a thing that is a wronging, that blame and guilt are appropriate, but nevertheless you're justified in doing it, something you ought to do, all things considered. Nevertheless, it would make sense for you not to do it, even though that would be unjustified. It would make sense because there's something to be said for not doing it, namely that you promised. Those are general points about obligation and justification. I've illustrated them with promise, but I think they're much much broader application. None of them are uncontroversial, unfortunately. Never mind. So let's talk a bit more about justified wrongs. So I want to say you can have a justified wrong, and in particular, you can be justified in breaching a binding promise, a promise which is valid. Just some examples. A quite obvious example of this is conflicting promises, where you double book yourself. Or I promise to loan someone a book and then discover that it's owned by someone else and I'd have to steal it in order to get the... So I have a conflicting obligation not to steal the book and also to give the book to the person I promised to give it to. Or, as I say, I'd double book myself for some social engagement. Here, I think very frequently, the right thing to say is that both of those conflicting obligations bind you. So whatever you do, you will be in a situation where guilt is appropriate and perhaps blame. And there's some reason to go both ways. But nevertheless, it may be pretty clear which way you ought to go, that you'd be justified in keeping one of the conflicting promises and not the other one, or justified in breaching the promise to loan the book to someone in order not to have to steal it, something like that. Okay, so that's and as I say, I'll be developing some examples of justified breach of promise as the paper goes on, but that's the general thought. Now there's a general point here which relates to the man in the back there, Henry Sidgwick. So Sidgwick says in The Method of Ethics that really common sense is very, very confused about when you ought to keep a promise. And there's nothing much to be got from common sense on this. You just get a whole set of conflicting verdicts. There's nothing of any... if you look at our intuitions about when one ought to keep promises, you just get a mess, basically. And nothing of any great theoretical interest. And that's why we need utilitarianism, to clear up the mess and tell us exactly when we ought to keep our promises. Now, I have some sympathy with Sidgwick's thought if we're talking about the question of when you are justified in keeping a promise, when you ought to keep a promise. That is going to be a question on which a whole set of diverse considerations bear. And so it's going to be enormously complicated. I mean, there will be obvious cases where there's nothing much to be said against keeping a promise, but you know, it may be very hard to say let's say I promised to meet Tim for lunch, right? I promised, and then the love of my life finally agrees to have lunch with me on the same day, which unfortunately isn't Tim at the moment. And I've been pursuing this person for years or for months or whatever. So this would, you know, and Tim likes me, but he won't be devastated if I don't show up for lunch. And it seems to me, you know, that one could go both ways on the question of whether I ought to show up to lunch because I promised, or whether rather I ought to take the better offer, as it were, or the enormously important romantic prospect. It seems to me there are cases in which I'd be justified in breaching my lunch promise, especially if I was able to inform him that I'm going to stand him up. But nevertheless, it's also pretty clear that I'd be wronging him, that I should feel somewhat guilty about this. I mean, this is exactly why you promise to have lunch with people, so you don't go away with a better offer. You know, that's, you're not meant to break promises for that reason, as it were. So I should feel somewhat guilty, and there's some reason to have it. It would make sense for me to have lunch with Tim because I promised, even though, you know, the love of my life was finally agreeing to see me. Right, but that shows you the complexity. You know, I doubt there's anything very general to be said about on the very general issue of whether you ought to keep a promise or not and when you ought to keep a promise. It's just going to be incredibly complicated and is going to involve lots of different kinds of considerations. But it may well nevertheless be true that we can say some fairly simple, relatively simple and theoretically interesting things about when promises are binding or valid, i.e. about when you ought to feel guilty about breach of them, or when they give you some reason to perform. That's a different question, and I think that's a much more tractable one than the question about justification. So that's one reason why it's very important to distinguish these two different questions, because I think we can make progress with at least one of them. Okay. So today I want to look at two different models of promissory obligation, and both of these I'll treat as models of the validity of a promise, not as addressing the question of when you're justified in keeping or breaking promises. And one I'll call the transfer model, and the other the interest model. The transfer model is a very venerable. It's been around since people started to think seriously about promissory obligation in the early modern period. For some reason, the ancients didn't seem very worried about promises as a philosophical issue. They're worried about the legal details, but not about the very phenomenon. But people got interested in the phenomena and the possibility of it in the early modern period. And all these guys came up with a similar sort of theory, Grotius, Pufendorf, Hobbes, Locke, Kant. And then what happened was it kind of went out of fashion a bit and has now come back into fashion with writers like Watson, Gary Watson, and Shana Schifrin, who've recently published a papers endorsing the transfer theory. And it's also quite fashionable among contract lawyers as well, They like the idea of the transfer theory. I'll tell you what the transfer theory is in a moment, but the other thing I'll contrast it with is what I call the interest model, which has a much more distinguished list of adherents. But I'll come to that later. So both models have something in common, which contrasts them with with another model of promising, which is much discussed, and I've participated in that discussion, but I'm not going to discuss it today, namely the expectations model of promise or obligation, with which some of you will be familiar. So this is the model which Adam Smith and Tim Scanlon and Adam Smith propounded it after Hume said some nasty things about the transfer model, and it's been revived in recent years by Tim Scanlon in his big book. And it's useful saying what it is just for contrast, so you can see what these guys all have in common. So on the expectations theory, the way it works is as follows. I promise to be at the bus stop at 4 o'clock. And what's going on there, according to the expectations theory, is that I'm communicating the intention of being at the bus stop at 4 o'clock. And the promise binds when you come to believe or expect that I will be there. And the idea is the wrong of breach of promise is I'm disappointing your expectation. That's the wrong. And there's no wrong if I don't make you expect it, or if I don't, or at least don't risk that you will come to expect it. So that's the expectations theory. Now, it's a quite popular theory, but I'm not going to discuss it. I'm going to set it aside. I'm mentioning it only to contrast it with both of these two, and both of these two take a rather different view of what's going on in promising. According to them, the essential thing about promising is you're not expressing the intention to do the thing you're promising to do. Rather, you're communicating the intention of obliging yourself to do it, which is a different thing, of hereby obliging yourself to do it. So the idea is that there's a kind of something which Hume regarded as magic going on. You're trying to bring it about that you're obliged to do it by announcing, I am hereby making it the case that I am obliged to do it. That's what's going on with the promise, according to both the transfer model and my own view. So you're creating the obligation, as I'll say, by declaration, by announcement, not by creating a significant psychological effect, namely making the guy rely on you. That often happens in promising, but it's inessential to the story. So it's kind of your, as it were, a little king, and you're announcing a law binding yourself. That's what you're doing. And this is in the jargon, an exercise of normative power. And both the transfer theorists and my own view is that that's what's going on, as opposed to the expectations view. Okay. So let's think about the transfer model in particular. What's the difference between these two models? Well, I'll elaborate on this a lot, but I'll just say it very briefly. On the transfer model, your power to promise to do something is explained by your prior possession of a right to do it. So the idea is, broadly speaking, that I have the power to promise you that I'll be at the bus stop at 4 o'clock, be in virtue of the fact that I have a right to decide whether I am there or not. So I can promise you that I'll be there because I have that power to promise you that I'll be there because I start off with the right to determine whether I will be there. And that power is kind of a product of that right. So I have a right to control the non-normative situation. I have a right to control whether my body is at the bus stop at 4 o'clock. I start off with that as, if you like, a natural right over my body. And it's because I have that natural right on the transfer theory that I also have this normative power, that I can create this obligation, and I can bind myself to be at the bus stop at 4 o'clock. So the normative power, the power to control the normative situation, is a product of my power over the non-normative situation, my authority to determine where my body is going to be at 4 o'clock. That's the transfer theory. Or at least that's the essence of the transfer theory. They also use the transfer metaphor, which I think is a bit mucks things up a bit, but we'll come on to that in a moment. On the interest model, the one I'll be advocating later, what's actually giving you the power to control the normative situation is not a prior right to control the non-normative situation. Rather, it's just that you have an interest in controlling the normative situation, that it's good for human beings to be able to control their rights and obligations. That's the idea. And that's a different view, as you'll see. But for a long time, I'm just going to be discussing the transfer theory and its merits and defects. All these models could be compared on many different dimensions. So today, because of the nature of the conference and time and so forth, we're just concerned with one very narrow issue, which is to do with whether a promise can be invalid or non-binding simply in virtue of the character of its content, simply in virtue of whether it's a promise to do something wrong, basically. And there are different views on that. So there are lots of reasons why you might think a promise can be invalid. For instance, I gave you an example earlier, duress. The promise was made only because you had a gun to your head. That's a way of invalidating a promise. That's not going to talk about that today. I'm going to talk about a very specific grounds for invalidating a promise, namely the idea that promises are invalid when they have a wicked or immoral content, when you're promising to do something wicked or immoral. You can't do that, according to some theories. It doesn't bind. So that's the issue. Okay. So there's a recent statement of the transfer model from Shana Shiffrin. So just read through that. The rights transfer theory claims that a binding promise affects a transfer from the promisor to the promisee, that she's a lawyer, through the communicated intent to do so, of the promisor's right to decide to act otherwise than how she promised to act. The transfer explains why the promisor is bound to perform. He no longer has a moral right to decide whether to do otherwise. It further explains why the promisee has the power to waive performance. The moral permission of the promisor to decide how to act otherwise now lies in the hands of the promisee, and the promisee may exercise this permission. The theory thereby explains the basic structure of the promisee relationships with satisfying simplicity. So the idea is that I, the promisor, start out with the right to be at the bus stop, or not, as the case may be, as I determine at 4 o'clock. Then I somehow transfer this right to decide whether I'm at the bus stop to you, like I might transfer my car or my dog. You know, it's a kind of property transfer. And you end up possessing my right to determine whether I'm at the bus stop at 4 o'clock. That's how promises work. Now, as I said, there's lots of stuff here which one could go into, rather pedantic stuff about, well, now what is exactly this normative item that's transferred? But I'm not going to press them on any of that. I'm just interested, as I say, in this claim that you have this power to promise, this power to control the normative situation, because you start out with this right to control the non-normative situation, this right to decide where your body is at a certain time. That's the crucial thing to take away from that. And of course, once the other guy's got your rights, once the promisee's got your right to be at the bus stop, he can exercise the right both ways. He can release you from the promise. So it's not just he can insist that you show up, he can also decide that you don't have to show up. So the power of release is explained on this model. And that's the power of release is absolutely crucial to a promise. I think I agree with them about that. So there we are. So now, the feature of the theory which I want to draw attention to today, which is relevant to the workshop, is what limits this places on promissory obligation, in particular what limits it places on the content of valid promises. So here's Mr. Grotius from, let's say, 1621, something like that, you know, sort of. To make a promise firm, it is requisite that the thing promised either now is or may be in the power of the promisor. Wherefore, in the first place, it is certain that no promise can oblige us to do that which is in itself unlawful. For no man has a power to do any such thing, or can have. But a promise receives its force from the power of the promisor, nor does it reach any further. So the idea there is that I can make this promise to be at the bus stop because I have the right to be at the bus stop. If I didn't have the right to be there, I couldn't make the promise. So I can't make a binding promise to murder your mother-in-law. I can't do it because I don't start out with the right to murder your mother-in-law. So I can't give you the right to determine whether I murder your mother-in-law by transferring that right to you. I can't. If I don't own the house, I can't sell it. You know, that's the idea. Okay. So as Shana Shiffrin says, an elegant and neat account of the limits of the promissory transaction. Now, I think there are two interpretations of what is going on there, that little passage from Grotius. a strong one and a weak one. There's a strong claim and a weak claim. And I think neither of them hold up, actually, but the stronger one is more obviously problematic. So let me distinguish the two. So the strong interpretation is simply this, that a promise does not bind whenever its fulfillment would wrong someone. So the idea is that any promise such that fulfilling it would involve wronging someone, promisor, promisee, third party, doesn't matter, is not a binding promise. That's the claim. And that's the view of Hobbes, for instance. He's very explicit. That's his view. Now, if that's true, some of the things I said earlier about conflicting obligations couldn't possibly be true. For instance, you couldn't be bound by two conflicting promises, right? Because the point about being bound by two conflicting promises is you have to wrong someone. The fulfillment of one of them will wrong the other guy, if you've double booked yourself for lunch or something. So that situation would be impossible if a promise couldn't bind whenever its fulfillment will wrong someone. You couldn't be in that situation. And similarly, you couldn't be in a situation of being bound to give someone a book which you didn't own but would have to steal because you promised them the book. That would be impossible. I think you can be in that situation. I think this view is probably confuses bindingness with justification. So it's no doubt true you can't be justified in fulfilling both promises, and apart from anything else, it's probably going to be impossible to fulfill both promises. You're going to have to choose, and one of them is probably going to be the one you ought to go for rather than the other. Nevertheless, both are binding. Both are such that if you breach them, you ought to feel some guilt. Both are such that it makes sense to fulfill them, that there's some reason to fulfill them, that it wouldn't just be a sort of random reflex if you were to go and if I was to fulfill the less pressing promise. It would be unjustified, but it would be an action for which there was some rationale, namely in the promise. So I think this is far too strong. Since we're in Sidgwick Hall, I'm just going to give you one argument which Henry Sidgwick gives for why this is so, why you can't have conflicting obligations, and in particular, you can't have a promise, a valid binding promise that conflicts with another obligation that you've got. So he thinks that would have an absurd result if that were so, if you could make a promise to do something that you were obliged not to do, i.e. double book yourself or promise to loan a book you didn't own. Well, what does he say? Well, he says that if that were possible, you could make it the case that you were justified in not discharging any particular obligation simply by promising not to discharge it. Right? So if I'm, for instance, I'm obliged to be here giving this talk, that's an obligation. Well, Sidgwick says, if what I said was true about promising were true, I could make it the case that I was justified in not doing that simply by promising James to have lunch with him instead, right? And wouldn't that be wonderful? Then I wouldn't be obliged to do this anymore. And that's absurd, to think you can get out of any obligation just by making an appropriate promise. Appropriately solemn and serious promise, perhaps. That would be absurd, but whether it's absurd or not depends on quite how you read that. It is quite generally true that I can get out of I can make it the case that I'm justified in not discharging my obligations by behaving badly in certain ways. So, for instance, I could have made it the case that I'm not that I'm justified in not showing up to this talk by breaking the leg of someone outside on Sidgwick Avenue. Because then I would have had an obligation to take them to the hospital, and then I would have been justified in not turning up at this talk. Right? That's all true, I think. I am justified in not turning up at this talk if I break someone's leg on Sidgwick Avenue, and then I really ought to take them to hospital, you know. So, and making a promise to have lunch with James rather than talk here is rather like doing that, right? So it really might be that because I've, perhaps not a lunch promise, but a much more serious one, you know, that I really ought not to give this talk because I've made this rather solemn promise. But that's about justification, and of course, that's not going to get me off complaint because the question will just be, why did I make that promise? I wasn't justified in making the promise. Why did I break the guy's leg? Right. But still, once I've made the promise, once I've broken the guy's leg, I do have an obligation. Right? I've acquired that obligation. And I'm blameworthy if I breach it, even though I am justified in breaching it. So here again, we need the idea of a justified wronging. And that's what Sidgwick's missing. That's why he thinks this argument is a good one. Okay, so that was the strong interpretation, that the idea that a promise does not bind whenever its fulfillment would wrong someone. So let's go for a weaker interpretation. So now there's a crucial phrase in the original Grotius poet. He says, which is in itself unlawful. So in itself. So that seems like something more than its fulfillment would wrong someone, because would wrong someone sounds like it might be, as it were, an accident that it would wrong someone. Yeah, I mean, you know, but it's only, you know, I'm only wronging someone by having lunch with James because I happen to have made another promise. Yeah, there's nothing intrinsically immoral about having lunch with James. So perhaps what we're concerned with here is things which are intrinsically wicked or immoral. That's the category of things that you can't make promises to do, rather than things which, as it were, are accidentally immoral or accidentally involve wronging people. So that's the weak interpretation. And this, Shona Shiffrin, you know, gives this list: theft, assault, murder, or fraud. So here's, you might think, a more plausible claim. So on this view, non-wicked conflicting promises might be valid, because there's nothing intrinsically immoral about having lunch with this person or with this person. And the promise to lend someone a book might be valid, because there's nothing intrinsically immoral about lending them a book. Just so happens you're in circumstances where you can't do that without wronging someone. But still, it might be a valid promise. So will this work? Well, the problem is this. I don't think this, I mean, whether or not it's true, and I won't comment on its truth, it won't give these people what they want. Because they want the class of wicked promises to be a fairly significant class of promises, which they can invalidate. So, for instance, they want the following promise to be part of this category. Suppose I'm short of money, so I go to the master criminal with a few of my colleagues, and I promise to rob a bank. Right? That's presumably the kind of promise they don't like. Right? You might think robbery should appear on this list. You know. So they would want that promise not to be binding, presumably, I assume. But if you think about it, if we arrived at the bank and the bank was, you know, the bank had just been taken over by some benevolent person who had opened the vaults to the general public, and we happened to get there first, and so we could simply walk into the bank and take away the money, the guy we made the promise to will not complain about that. He's happy to get the money. In fact, he'd probably be happy that we didn't have to rob the bank. What he wants is the money, right? So we will have fulfilled our promise. It would only matter that we robbed the bank if this was part of an anarchist plot and we were trying to undermine the capitalist system. Then, of course, we couldn't do that by taking money from a bank which was happy to give it to us. So perhaps anarchist promises or something like that would be ruled out by this, but ordinary criminal promises would not be, because criminals are very happy to get what they want without having to use violence, and then, unless they're pathological. Yeah. So it looks as if there would be a whole class of promises that would not be covered by this proposal. So what can we do about this? Well, one thing you might do is you might say, well, look, okay, so fair enough. What we're concerned with then is promises where something like it can be foreseen that there will be a wronging if the promise is fulfilled. Something like that. Let's try that one. So promise is invalid when someone can foresee that a wronging will be a byproduct of its being fulfilled. And that will certainly... The mafioso will foresee that you'll have to rob the bank in order to get the money. Right? So that's why the promise is invalid. So the question is, who will have to foresee in order for the promise to be invalid? Who? So there's two possible candidates, the promisor and the promisee. The promisor, the guy making the promise, and the promisee, the guy receiving it. Well, now, it can't be the promisor if what I've said is so far true. Because I've said that I think the promisor can knowingly make conflicting promises. They can double book themselves. They can do it by accident. They can also do it deliberately. And they can make binding promises, promises which they will be held to. So I sort of, you know, quite like to have lunch with A, so I make a lunch with promise to, with A to have a lunch, and then a much more attractive offer arrives from B, so I make a promise to B. And I know about all this. I'm not confused about the situation. No doubt I might hope that A will release me, but I have no expectation that they will. I just hope that they will, you know. And if they don't, then I'm stuck. I have two obligations. I should feel guilty about this situation. You know? And I foresaw it. So that can't be what's going on. It can't be my foresight invalidates. So perhaps it's the... What should I go into this complication? No, I won't. So perhaps it's the promisee who has to foresee. Perhaps the thought is the promise is invalid when the guy you give the promise to can see that the fulfillment of the promise would likely involve wronging someone. Perhaps that's what's going on. But I'm not convinced by that, because partially because of the general thought that really the promisee's attitude should be that it's up to the promiser to determine how to fulfill his promise. You know, that's his business. He's got that kind of responsibility. And it may not be clear to me how he can fulfill his promise consistent with his family responsibilities or whatever it might, work responsibilities or whatever. And I might well anticipate and not be surprised if this turns out to be impossible. But that doesn't invalidate the promise. If he freely makes it and I freely accept it and so on and so forth. If he's got himself into a mess, he's got himself into a mess. That's his affair. So I think we've come to the end of the road with the transfer theory. I mean, there are various things to say about the transfer theory, but one of the advantages of the theory is it looked as if it would provide an incredibly simple explanation of why you were not bound by nasty, wicked promises, right? Namely the lack of the ownership of the right you needed to transfer. But when you start to think about the details, in fact, it's very plausible to think that some promises we are bound by, even though they involve wronging someone. And so the problem then becomes to distinguish those promises from the really nasty ones, right, that we're not bound by, you might think. But I haven't seen an account of how that can be done on this theory. So let's move on to something else. So here is a claim that I think is true, that I want to endorse myself and which the transfer theorists will want to endorse. But I'll call it power shift. So this is what's going on. So there's no talk of transfer here, but this is nevertheless what's going on in promising. Before promising, I have the power to determine whether or not I would be wronging you by failing to show up, if it's a promise to show up. I possess the power to promise to appear, so I start off with this power to determine whether I'm obliged to appear. This is a power I exercise by declaration, by communicating the intention of hereby exercising that power, or not as the case may be. Having successfully promised, I can no longer determine by declaration whether or not I would be wronging you by failing to show up, so I can't back out, in other words. I'm obliged, I'm bound. I can't rescind my promise. Furthermore, once I have successfully promised, you thereby acquire the power to determine whether or not I would be wronging you by failing to show up. For you have the power to release me from my obligation, or not. So you now have the power of release, or to decline release. So you get to determine whether I'm wronging you by not showing up. This again is a power you exercise by declaration, by announcement, by communicating the intention of hereby exercising that power. Okay, so that's what's going on in promising, I think. So how can that be what's going on? How can people have this influence over the normative situation, over their rights and obligations, if it's not by transferring rights to control the non-normative situation? So here's the interest model of promising. So the basic idea is this, that human beings, you know, some things are good for them and some things are bad for them. Yeah. And where something's good or bad for them, where something matters to them, where having it makes their life go better or worse, it's not always the case, but it's very often the case that it's also a good thing for them to have control over that thing. For various reasons have been offered for this. We didn't even go into exactly, it might be important ways of expressing themselves or of just of getting the best result or something like that. But where something matters to people, it's very often the case that it also matters to them to have control over whether they have it. Not just to have it, but to actually control whether they have it or not. So, you know, marriage would be an obvious thing. Marriage, you may think having a lifelong sexual partner is a good thing. And that's a very important good in life. And many people infer from that that it's a good part of life to control who you marry, right? To choose that. And that's not just a function of the idea that you'll get the better result that way. You may or may not. Notoriously, you probably won't. Right? But nevertheless, your life might go better if you have that power rather than someone else having that power, even though your parents might make a better choice. That's a very common idea, which I won't defend today, but we can certainly talk about it. And it's nothing particularly to do with what I'm going to say about promising, but I do want to take advantage of it because I want to say that... And this is controversial. I want to say that among the goods in human life are things like rights, obligations, permissions, and various normative facts like what is appropriate and that kind of stuff. Now, that's a more controversial claim because the standard view is that insofar as those things matter, they matter for instrumental reasons because they have various effects which were desirable. But I'm happy to talk about that again, but I don't think that's right. I think that these are actually on the list, alongside truth, beauty, pleasure, there's obligation, rights, and permissions. You know, there's just on the list of human goods, rather long list, friendship, blah, blah, blah. So suppose that's right. Suppose that's right. Then, potentially at least, these things are all also on the list of things it's good to control. Not all good things are good things to control, like surprise parties. They're good, but it's not good to control them. Otherwise, they wouldn't get the surprise. But, and maybe surprise obligations are not. But most obligations and rights, they can be on the list. And they're things that it's desirable to have control over. Your life goes better if you have control. And that's why we have the power to promise. Because it's good for us to have this social institution that gives us this kind of control over the normative situation around us, that enables us to control when we're obliged to be a certain place and who we're obliged to have children with and so on and so forth. That's the source of the normative force of a promise. Now, just suppose all that's right. Now, notice I have not derived this power from some right to control the non-normative situation. I've not said that I have the power to promise to be at the bus stop because I have the right to determine whether I actually am at the bus stop. I did not say that. Rather, I said I have the power to determine whether I'm obliged to be at the bus stop because I have an interest in having the power to determine whether I'm at the bus stop. I have an interest in controlling my obligations. So that's a rather different view. And it doesn't deliver any very immediate or obvious constraint on the content of promises in the way the other view does. Because all I've said was we have an interest in controlling obligations. And we might have an interest in controlling all sorts of obligations, including the, as it were, the nasty ones, right? So this view doesn't deliver the very obvious constraint on the validity of promises that the transfer theory did. You need more details in order to settle where the limits are. So let me just say where I don't think the limits are and then where I do think the limits are and then I'll stop. So I think it's actually... There are actually not many promises that are invalid in virtue of their wicked content. I think the Führer oath, the oath of loyalty that the Germany's soldiers swore to Adolf Hitler, could well have been a binding promise. Right? Of course, they were justified in breaking it, sure, but that's not what I mean by a binding promise, as you know. A binding promise is simply a promise such that there's some reason to keep it. It makes sense to keep it because you made the promise, And it did make sense. I mean, a German officer could have thought, look, there's nothing to be said for this war. It's all going badly, we're massacring people. But there is one thing to be said for carrying on, namely I made a solemn oath. That would make sense. Of course, you know, you want to say this guy is suffering from weakness of will if he carries on, just because he made the oath, because there's so much to be said on the other side. But nevertheless, it wouldn't be like he'd been hypnotized by Hitler, and he was just sort of sleepwalking into carrying on. There would actually be a reason, something which made his action intelligible. And the thing was the oath. I've used a more provocative example than I intended, but I saw you were falling asleep, so... And the other connotation was guilt and blame. It would make sense for people to feel, you know, if I, you know, agree to rob a bank or something like that, I bound myself into an immoral enterprise. And it is a breach of faith with my fellow robbers. And, you know, it's not a trivial matter. They are going to be exposed to all sorts of terrible consequences if I do not show up to drive the getaway car or if I walk away halfway through the robbery. That is a very significant matter. And it seems to me it would be very odd if I didn't feel rather not just a sort of regret, but actual guilt about doing that. I would not be taking my commitment seriously. But nevertheless, of course, it may well be justified to do that because of all the things to be said against bank robbery. So it seems to me that even in the case of rather obviously wicked promises, the promise might well bind. One thing, as Shana Schifrin says, of the transfer theorists, she's the most concerned about the phenomenon I've talked about. And a lot of the transfer theorists think that it's obvious that immoral promises don't bind, and so it's a great feature of their theory that it delivers this immediately. Okay. But Shana doesn't think that, actually. She sees it's actually quite unobvious that these promises don't bind. And so she goes through a lot of manoeuvring in order to show why they appear to bind, even though they don't. And one thing she says, I'll just say as an example, one thing she says, which is that she thinks that in a lot of these cases, what's going on is that you're wronging the promisee, the guy you make the promise to, but you're not wronging the promisee by breaching the promise, rather you're wronging the promisee by misrepresenting yourself as having the power to make the promise. Yeah? So it's a kind of lying or insincerity is the wrong. Yeah? Okay. And that's a nice but I don't think that'll do really, because it may well. I mean, for a start, you'd have to think that a misrepresentation could be significant, even though the guy wasn't deceived, you know, because lots of people won't be deceived by your misrepresentation, but they'll be happy to accept your promise if it'll make it more likely you'll do it. All right. But even setting that aside, think of a case where you're released from the promise, where for some reason your fellow bank robbers release you. Well, then you'll be relieved, won't you, that you've been released. My God, I've been released. But you'll already have done the misrepresenting that she said. You'll have misrepresented yourself as making a valid promise to rob the bank. So it seems there must be a further wrong of breach over and above, which you've avoided in that case, over and above the wrong of misrepresentation. So that explanation won't work, I think. So what are the limits of validity? If the Hitler oath is binding, if, you know, so on and so forth, what are the limits on this interest theory? Well, here, I mean, there are a number of promises which would be problematic. I'm not completely sure that they would be invalid, but the shape of the interest theory would render them problematic. One is a promise to break a promise. Okay. I think there's something... If the point of promises is to serve people's interest in controlling the normative situation, then using that device in order to create an obligation which is directly contradictory to the one you've just used it to create in that very act, there's something strange about that. I wouldn't go further than that, but anyway, there's something intrinsically problematic about that. Another interesting category is the category of self-binding promises. So suppose I want to give up smoking. So one way I might do that, there's only one tobacconist in town, so I go to the tobacconist and I say, promise not to sell me any cigarettes, and don't allow me to release you from that promise. Crucial, because of course I'll be back the next day trying to release him from the promise. Yeah? Now, if that promise is binding, it seems to me that there's something strange about that, because it doesn't give the promisee any control over the normative situation. Remember, the control over the normative situation came from the power of release, right? And the whole point of this promise is to not have the power of release. Otherwise, you wouldn't be binding yourself, right? But I think there's something paradoxical about this promise. I think if you were the tobacconist, and you know this guy, I came to you the first day and say, please don't sell me any cigarettes, and don't, you know, accept any release from this promise. And then I came back the next day and I said, please, please give me the cigarettes, I release you. It would be very obvious what I should do there, what would constitute wronging you and what wouldn't constitute wronging you. Because kind of the point of the thing, the institution, is not clearly being served by this transaction. It's unclear what kind of wronging is being generated here and how I could avoid it. The final category of promises is promises the effect of which is to deprive you of the power to promise. So enslavement is the obvious, voluntary enslavement. So a good example from Grotius is where you gamble yourself into slavery. And the thing, so you'll get £1 million or you'll be my slave. Right? So that's contract. Could that bind? Could I end up with you as my slave? Well, one of the things about slaves is they can't make contracts and promises which are morally significant, at least in the standard conception of slavery. So you'd be depriving yourself of the power to promise by contract. And that might be problematic if the interest theory is correct, because you'd be directly assaulting the very interest which is the whole institution is meant to serve. So I think those kinds of promises would be a bit dubious, but they would be dubious in virtue of their content. There would be something about their content which made them dubious. But the kind of standard wicked promise, it seems to me, would still stand as a valid binding obligation, though no doubt one you're justified in violating. Thanks a lot.